The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Precision and Progress Against NF1, Solutions for Better Outcomes with MEKI and Multimodal Care for NF1 PNF and Other Tumors. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/XSH860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining us today in our session about precision and progress against NF1. We are all looking for solutions for better outcomes with MEK inhibitors and multimodal care for NF1 plexiform neurofibromas and other tumors. First, I wanted to welcome you all and do some quick introductions. My name is Amy Sato, and this is...
I am Carlos Romo.
And, okay, so our goals for today, we would hope to enhance your understanding of the evidence and guidelines that support the modern treatment of NF1-related tumors. We'll like to strengthen your ability to develop evidence-based treatment plans that include MEK inhibitors and have all of that rooted in really sound prognostic information and safety considerations. We'll also like to equip you with techniques for managing the practical aspects of patient care, including dosing, monitoring, and adverse event management. So we'll start with a quick introduction about neurofibromatosis, and this is an umbrella term to incorporate the genetic neurocutaneous disorders that predispose to benign and malignant tumors that can develop in the central and in the peripheral nervous system. Most are benign, but can lead to significant clinical concerns, and some of these tumors can even have malignant degeneration. The most common type of neurofibromatosis that we'll be spending the majority of our time talking about is neurofibromatosis type 1, or NF1. And this is, again, caused by a mutation in the neurofibromin 1 gene. It can affect from head to toe multiple different systems. And it's actually very common, affecting more than 120,000 Americans, 2 million people worldwide. And every day, 120 new patients are diagnosed just in the U.S. with NF1. The other main category, again, under this umbrella term of neurofibromatosis are schwannomatoses as well. And these are all dependent on the genetic variant that is causing their predisposition to form schwannomas. And so the most common of these schwannomatoses is NF2, related schwannomatosis. And you will see that there's been a recent change in the diagnostic criteria to incorporate other schwannomatoses, again, based on their underlying gene change. This is more for your reference, but as a brief background on NF1 genetics, half of our patients with NF1 inherit the NF1 gene change in an autosomal dominant pattern, and half of the cases of patients with NF1 happen de novo. We have full penetrance with variable expression, meaning that if someone has a gene change in their NF1 gene, then they will have some clinical signs of NF1. However, the actual clinical signs of that NF1 phenotype may vary, even within families with the same genetic variant change. So recently in 2021, there was a revised diagnostic criteria that I won't go into detail today, but again, here for a reference. But I will point out that there were some recent changes incorporating also genetic confirmation or a pathogenic NF1 variant as one of the two or more criteria that can be used for meeting the diagnosis of NF1. Again, this is also for your reference too, but I will say more and more that genetic testing is playing a role in NF1. The majority of patients can be clinically diagnosed by the age of 10, but there are many times some cases that people agree on that molecular testing for NF1 could also be helpful. The testing is very accurate in looking at gene changes within the NF1 gene, and now we have some agreement, again, no strict guidelines about when we will be doing testing, but it is becoming more and more common. And this is also more for your reference, but just reviewing some of the non-tumoral impacts of NF1, just because we're going to be spending the majority of our time talking about the tumoral impacts of NF1. The classic clinical feature of NF1 are the skin findings of the cafe au lait macules, as you can see here, as well as skin fold freckling, most predominantly in the bilateral axilla or in the bilateral inguinal region. Other classic hallmark features for NF1 include ocular manifestations, including these Lish nodules, which are hamartomas that are asymptomatic and have no effect on vision, as well as choroidal abnormalities. And this choroidal abnormalities was also included as part of the ocular manifestations in the most recent diagnostic criteria update. I would be remiss to not mention the significant aspects of cognition and behavior that are affected in NF1, including up to 80% of children with NF1 having neurocognitive and behavioral impairment, up to 25% of kids with NF1 having autism spectrum disorder, and up to 40% of our kids with NF1 having social dysfunction. As I mentioned before, the NF1 can affect from head to toe, and here is a summary of the multiple systems that can be affected with NF1 as well. And then moving closer towards our topic today of the tumoral impacts of NF1, I just wanted to highlight here some examples of dermal neurofibromas. These are cutaneous or subcutaneous lesions of that we can see and are hallmark of NF1. We are not going to be spending much time discussing these dermal neurofibromas. I will just hint and say that this is an active point of research and that hopefully we'll have a great updates in the future about the treatment for these tumors, but we'll be spending the most of our time talking about these other tumors associated with NF1, including plexiform neurofibromas, optic pathway gliomas, and other low-grade tumors, as well as malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors. And with that, I will change over to my colleague here.
Thank you. So we thought we'd present a case and talk through the case and think about how we would treat this patient and the topics we set out to discuss with you today. So this is a patient I saw in clinic. Although I'm an adult neurologist, I see some kids from time to time. And I saw this 2-year-old who was brought to clinic by her mom saying that she was diagnosed with NF1 soon after birth based on skin manifestations, but that they had noticed that in her right hand, there was something that was growing and that it had been growing for the last 6 months. And it felt like a soft mass that maybe was involving the hand and a little bit of the wrist. They said that it had been increasing in size, but not really interfering much with her activities, except perhaps causing some pain here and there, especially if she bumped it on something or if someone grabbed her arm and touched her. Sometimes she would grimace and make signs that she was in pain. So I examined the patient, and grossly her strength was good. Grip and the rest of the muscle groups in her arm and elsewhere were doing really well. The kid was playing with an iPad as I was chatting with mom, and fine coordination looked fine. And she had no signs of pain when I was seeing her, but she clearly had a mass that was not only involving the palmar aspect of the hand, but was also involving the wrist. And I maybe thought that some part of the forearm could have been involved as well. But I couldn't really tell just from observing and palpating the full extension of this lesion. So I kind of started thinking about what symptoms would concern me about this tumor, if it was a tumor, and what are the next steps in my evaluation of this tumor. So I thought of obtaining an MRI. MRI is really the gold standard for evaluating plexiform neurofibromas. We try to avoid exposure to radiation, so X-rays and CT scans, we try to avoid as much as possible if we can get an MRI. And usually we get an MRI with contrast if possible, and we get, in some centers, diffusion weighted sequences to measure ADC values that can help us determine if there's any concern for malignancy. But as you can see in this particular case, the patient's hand is down here. You can see a little bit of the thumb, the second and third digits here, and you can see that there is this bright hyperintense mass here that goes all the way up to the forearm and even extends higher up into the proximal part of the arm. And it's involving both the median and ulnar nerves. So it's possibly two distinct plexiform-like tumors that really extend widely through her arm. So let's talk a little bit about NF1 biology, mechanism of tumor development, and we'll come back to that case and talk about what we did, how we thought about her case, and what were the next steps in her management. So as Amy was saying before, neurofibromin is the protein that is translated through NF1, and it acts as a negative regulator of RAS signaling. So I put a picture here of the MAP kinase pathway, and you can see all the cascade of secondary effectors here. And NF1, or neurofibromin, is a GTPase regulator of RAS. So what it does, it catalyzes that RAS-GTP to RAS-GDP, inactivating this cascade and its downstream effects, which will result in cellular proliferation. So it's a classic tumor suppressor gene. And these tumors, plexiform neurofibromas, I tell my young patients, are not always there. They only happen in about 40 to 50, some people will say up to 60% of people living with NF1 will have these tumors. They are composed of different types of cells. It's not just Schwann cells. And they probably have a positive feedback loop with those surrounding cells and the microenvironment that promote their growth. They are benign tumors, they're not cancerous, but they can cause a lot of morbidity, including pain, some neurologic deficits, and sometimes they can be life-threatening when they are compressing the greater vessels or displacing the trachea. And of course, when they transform to a sarcoma or a malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor, they can be the leading cause of directly NF1-related death in people with NF1. And you here see some pictures of MRIs of a patient with a significant burden of plexiform neurofibroma. Some of them are visible, some of them not so much. And we know from some natural history studies that these tumors are felt to be congenital, meaning that the second hit that causes their formation happens very early on. However, they may not be apparent in early infancy. Their growth typically follows the growth of the children as they are growing in the first years of life. And you can see from these two graphs here that the majority of growth happens between age 0 and 10, with some cases growing afterwards. As I said, mostly I see adult patients, and certainly I know people in their 40s and 50s that have growing plexiform neurofibromas, but the majority of cases of growth are seen in early childhood. And you can see these are tumor size by surface area of plexiform neurofibromas as measured by MRIs and two-dimensional measurements. And you can see that in adulthood, you can see some growth, but usually these curves remain stable. So it's pretty erratic, and we can't, unfortunately right now, predict what the tumor growth will look like. But some of these tumors can have extended periods of stabilization where there might not be any growth at all. So, given her large tumor burden in her right upper extremity and that she has some symptoms, we were considering starting some treatment. And again, I'll guide you through the process of how we thought about her treatment options. But we decided that if we were going to start some treatment, it'd be good to stage her tumor burden and see whether she had other plexiform neurofibromas in other places that we would monitor as she is treated. So we are lucky that we have the ability to get a whole body MRI, and that's what we did. The whole body MRI was scheduled 3 months after her initial presentation, and luckily it did not show any additional plexiform neurofibromas in other places. She just had the one in the right arm and hand. And luckily it also showed that in that 3 month interval, there was no objective growth of that plexiform neurofibroma. So what factors should inform our decisions about treating, and is surgery indicated in this case? So not all plexiform neurofibromas need to be treated. And that's very important to understand that, as I said before, some of these tumors can be completely asymptomatic and be stable for many years without causing any morbidity. So sometimes we just monitor these patients by bringing them routinely for physical exam, neurologic examinations, and when necessary, also periodic MRIs to more objectively measure the size and the MRI characteristics of these tumors. So the age of the patient is considered, whether patients are telling us that they're progressing is considered, and of course, if there's pain or disfigurement or functional deficits. Sometimes they're not causing pain or neurologic deficits, but the disfigurement is enough to cause the patient to have problems with self-esteem, depression, anxiety, and that might be itself an indication for some form of treatment. Sometimes I also tell my patients that even if they're feeling well, if the tumor is progressing a little bit and it's in a very critical area, let's say there's a paraspinal neurofibroma touching the spinal cord and I'm afraid that it's growing, even if they're feeling great at that point, if there is radiographic evidence of tumor progression, I might still recommend treatment in an asymptomatic patient if there's signs of impending morbidity. So how do we treat them? Chemotherapy, and by chemotherapy, I mean cytotoxic traditional chemotherapy, has really not been proven to be very effective, and as you well know, can be very toxic in people with NF1. So traditional chemotherapy for benign plexiform neurofibromas really has no established role. It is also unclear the benefits of radiation therapy, but what we know is that for sure it increases the risk of a secondary cancer transformation many years after the treatment was provided. And if this is a tumor predisposition syndrome, so we want to minimize as much as possible any additional risk for cancerous transformation. So again, for benign plexiform neurofibromas, the treatment, the radiation treatment is often not recommended. So surgery remains the standard of care for most patients with plexiform neurofibromas, but there are some considerations to take into account. Is it resectable without significant morbidity? Can a single surgery take care of the deficits, or does a patient need to have a staged procedure? What is it going to be the recovery, etc.? So there are different papers showing us that surgery comes not without any risks, and some complications can occur, including worsening neurologic deficits, worsening pain. And there are other papers where there's proof that if the tumors are not gross totally resected, there's a high likelihood of recurrence and tumor progression. 46% in this paper by Needle and 20% in the paper by Wen et al. And there are, of course, things that predict if surgery is going to be a good outcome or not, give us a good outcome or not. So if the patients tend to be younger, the less likely that they're going to have a significant benefit. And in this paper, age 10 was a cutoff where people who are older than 10 found more benefit. If the tumor was located in an area that was easily resected, then it was better for them, as opposed to a large plexiform neurofibroma like the one I showed, where there was tumor on both sides of the neck, wrapping around the vessels, wrapping around the trachea. That's a much more difficult surgery. And the extent of resection would probably be not ideal. So in the last table here, or not table, but graph here, you can see that the ones that are biopsied had further progression. Subtotal resections did a little bit better. So Amy, can you talk to us a little bit about what would our options be if we wanted to start some treatment?
An overview. There are many potential treatment targets in NF1. If we're thinking about the MAP kinase pathway that is very much involved in the pathogenesis of tumor development in our NF1 patients, there are definitely multiple areas where we can act upon that. There are some that are better than others, and I will spend some time talking about the research and the evidence of why some targeted treatments are now even FDA approved for the treatments of these plexiform neurofibromas. So I hopefully many of you are familiar with this trial. This was definitely a great a landmark study in the field of NF1. I still remember, I have tingles in my body from when I first saw the results of this study. So this sprint trial was an open label phase 2 trial looking specifically at the MEK inhibitor selumetinib. And then this was in pediatric patients with a plexiform neurofibroma that was deemed to be unresectable or inoperable and also was symptomatic with some kind of plexiform neurofibroma-related complication. They were then given selumetinib that was dosed based on their BSA, and they were looking primarily for volumetric change. Their primary endpoint was looking for a greater than 20% decrease in the plexiform neurofibroma volume. And volume for a 3D tumor like a plexiform neurofibroma really makes sense. And this was one of the first studies that was really honing in on that aspect. Secondary endpoints were also very important, looking at functional parameters, also including tolerability, their quality of life, as well as, of course, safety evaluations too. So the results of this trial were really exciting in that there was a partial response seen in about 68% of patients. And what I find sometimes even more exciting is that there was actually improvement in pain and function, which I think is ultimately our goal as clinicians for our patients. So this first graph here is looking at plexiform neurofibromas. The red line here is indicating what the natural history is in terms of progression-free survival for those plexiform neurofibromas that are just observed with MRIs and over time. You will see that the natural history very, very falls off very quickly in that the progression-free survival is essentially close to zero at a three-year mark. Versus our patients who have selumetinib for the treatment of their plexiform neurofibromas, their progression-free survival was fantastic over several years. This graph over here is what I was referring to in looking at the global impression of change. The darker blue numbers indicate much more improvement in their tumor-related morbidities, and the orangish colors are more indicative that they felt like those symptoms were worse. And you would see that parents and children predominantly felt that their symptoms were either very much improved or much improved, which is fabulous. Referring back to that 68% of response, this is a wonderful waterfall plot that's showing for each patient that received the selumetinib. You can see stability in the majority of these patients, as well as even significant volume change with treatment. And the colors here indicate length of treatment. The darker colors typically indicate kids who have been on treatment for longer. And so you can see the longer that the kids have been on selumetinib, it looks like the greater response that they were having. And perhaps some of these that didn't have a partial response were deemed as stable, maybe haven't been on the medication as long. So this led to the FDA approval of selumetinib in April of 2020. So it's now approved for pediatric patients over the age of 2 who have a symptomatic and inoperable plexiform neurofibroma. And as Carlos alluded to, significant disfigurement is considered symptomatic. There were some recent changes in the FDA labeling in that this is now able to be taken with or without food, which is amazing. And there are also some recommendations for those patients who may have moderate hepatic impairment or other reasons for needing a dose modification. This is only available in capsules, and unfortunately right now have to be swallowed whole. They are working on other formulations, but for now, for our purposes, this again is a twice daily medication that you have to swallow capsules for. So I'll lead next to a next promising MEK inhibitor, trametinib, which again is a MEK1/2 highly specific inhibitor. And this has been FDA approved and studied for a very long time in the treatment of melanoma. And so this is actually available off-label given the FDA approval in the other settings. This medication is available in pill and liquid formulation, but it has to be given on an empty stomach. However, it is in only a once-a-day dosing. So let's look to see about the safety and the efficacy of using trametinib. So very cleverly named TRAM study as opposed for our pediatric patients, which will be in contrast to the adult study that's called TRAIN. In our TRAM study, which I guess is like a baby train, it was a phase two study looking at trametinib in our pediatric patients with plexiform neurofibromas and low-grade gliomas. What I'll highlight here is that looking at a volumetric response, here we go. 64.7% also met or were able to have an overall response rate. And then 65.8% showed greater than 20% reduction in volume. Again, the same criteria that was used in other clinical trials. And that I will also highlight that 93% of these patients had durable response without progression lasting greater than a year. And in terms of the safety information, to date, only two pediatric patients have had to discontinue treatment due to adverse events. But one patient was discontinued just based on their treating provider's decision. So then I alluded to the adult form of this study called the TRAIN study. And so this was a phase two of trametinib given in adults with NF1-associated plexiform neurofibromas. This has been a little bit harder to recruit. They have had some pain reductions noted in their results. 67% of their patients have had pain reduction. But in terms of volume metrics, that is still an ongoing process. They do report that in one patient with a plexiform neurofibroma in the left shoulder region, the tumor was decreased by 38% after being on treatment for 18 months. The most common side effects for the trametinib that was seen in the adults was 65%, and there was a primary reason for discontinuing treatment. Four patients discontinued of the 17, three due to the adverse events and one due to increased pain. So I'll move on again to our tour through MEK inhibitors. We'll talk about mirdametinib, and this is, again, also a MEK1/2 inhibitor. It is not quite on the market yet. In March of this year, the pharmaceutical company applied a new drug application to the FDA, so it is predominantly available only through clinical trials at this time, but it is available as a pill as well as a dispersible tablet, and while it's given twice daily, can be taken with or without food, and it is a 3-week on, 1-week off regimen, which makes it a little bit different from our other MEK inhibitors. So looking at the efficacy and the safety of mirdametinib, their clever research study is called RENEW. And this is a phase 2B study that was looking at mirdametinib in both pediatric and adult patients with NF1-associated plexiform neurofibroma. What I'll say that, again, looking at the plexiform neurofibroma volume decrease of greater than 20%, 52% of the pediatric patients and 41% of the adult patients were able to meet that mark. And then there are also improvements in pain, quality of life, and physical function also reported. In terms of the safety, and when we're looking at grade 3 or higher adverse events, in the pediatric setting, 25% experienced those adverse events, as well as 16% in the adult patients. And the most common any grade adverse events reported include rash, diarrhea, vomiting, and nausea, similar to most other MEK inhibitors. And then the last MEK inhibitor that I will talk about is binimetinib, which, again, MEK1-2 inhibitor. And this is FDA approved when in used in combination with encorafenib for metastatic melanoma that has a particular BRAF V600E or 600K mutation. So it is possibly available off-label. It is available as a tablet, and you can take it twice daily with or without food. So this is a study that is currently active and looking at children and adults who are receiving binimetinib for the plexiform neurofibroma. And 70% of the pediatric patients achieved a partial response, as well as 65% of adult patients. However, you will see here that there were some initial toxicities, particularly in the adults, and had led to a dose reduction in the original dose of the binimetinib. And then there were, at the lower dosing, there were some grade 3 or higher toxicities, but they were significantly better tolerated. And then the last medication that I will talk about that has good research behind it for the treatment of plexiform neurofibromas is cabozantinib. And this is a multiple tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's been FDA approved for thyroid cancer. And so again, it's available off-label. This is available as capsules, and the dosing of it is once daily on an empty stomach. So there was a phase 2 trial looking at cabo in our NF1 patients. And this was looking at kids greater than 16 years old, so a little bit older than the other clinical research studies that I've mentioned. And also had a very interesting design in that patients were removed from a study if at certain points they didn't reach tumor reduction. So if they didn't have more than 15% tumor reduction after cycle 8, they were removed. And then again, after cycle 12, if they didn't have more than 20% tumor reduction, they were removed. The reason why I mentioned this that is that if that the results of this, I think, are have to be taken in lieu of those different study design. So there were 19 patients that were eligible for response evaluation. Five of those completed all planned therapy. And again, several of them were removed because of the not meeting the criteria for the tumor volume reduction. There were also some who were removed for dose-limiting toxicities. And then there were also those who withdrew because of low-grade adverse events. And so any grade adverse events, that seemed like the majority of the patients did also experience those. In terms of the efficacy, 8 of the 19, so 42%, had a PR. 11 had stable disease. And so this is a waterfall plot looking at each of the patients and their response.
Okay. Other points for discussion is how do you treat this patient, for how long, and how do you screen for toxicities and prepare the patient to start treatment? Does MEK inhibition or another TKI prevent malignancy? So in this patient, we decided to start selumetinib. It was a little bit an easier path because of its FDA approval to start that treatment. So we tried to teach her how to use the capsules. She learned how to use capsules and take them. So she started on selumetinib and has been on selumetinib for a few months now. But how long do I treat this patient for? How do I monitor and all that stuff? So none of these medications are easy to take. They all come with potential side effects, some of them more common than others, and they all come with a bunch of monitoring. And so I always tell my patients that it is a commitment to start any of these medications because they will have to be monitored for all of these potential problems. So toxicities that are very common are GI and skin. A lot of patients will develop a skin rash. The skin rash and paronychia and other problems are a little bit different pediatric versus adult patients. So if you're treating a young kid versus a 16, 18 year old, the adverse events might be slightly different, but dry skin, rash of different forms, acne form being the most common one, paronychia, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, things like that are very common. And patients will need to be monitored even before the treatment starts with eye exams, echocardiograms, blood work and seen in clinic for their symptoms very, very often, about 3 to 3 months between visits. And I don't have here the exact list of everything that needs to be monitored, but if you refer to the FDA label, you'll see what the warning signs are and what exactly needs to be monitored and how often. So it's very helpful in that regard. So to the question about does MEC-I prevent malignant transformation, the answer is we don't know, but we think not. So I never counsel my patients and say you should start this treatment so that you don't get MPNST. I never say that because there's no data to support that MEK inhibition prevents malignant transformation. And in fact, there are some case reports, including a couple that we've put here, of people on MEK inhibition that developed MPNST while on treatment. So how long do we need to treat these patients for? So going back to the SPRINT study and the patients in that trial, this is an example of one patient who had been monitored for 14 years, a long period of evaluation. And at different time points, this patient was getting different MRIs. And they saw that this patient had a clear progression of one of their plexiform neurofibromas. And they decided to start treatment at one point around this area here with selumetinib as part of the clinical study. The tumor continued to grow. 5 cycles into treatment, there was still some progression, but around cycle 6, they saw that the tumor was growing and the patient had developed low ejection fraction problems, as seen on their echocardiogram, so they decided to stop selumetinib at this point here when they had already seen some shrinkage. So the tumor had decreased in size on treatment after 5 cycles of therapy, developed problems, the treatment was stopped. They monitored the patient again, and their tumor, while stopping the treatment, had grown back to the same kind of curve that it had been following before treatment. Fortunately, the ejection fraction improved, and the patient was able to resume treatment with selumetinib, and the tumor shrank back down. So, a couple of things that we can conclude from this graph is that, for one thing, the tumors don't disappear, and Amy was showing you the waterfall plots where we didn't see in any case that there was complete response. In any case, unfortunately, the best response was about 60 to 70% response, which is great. And there was clearly benefit in clinical symptoms, but the tumors never completely disappeared. That's also something I tell my patients. And if for whatever reason we have to stop treatment, there's a chance that the tumor will grow back up to where it was before. So, fortunately, last year, there's another publication by the team at the NIH who ran this study primarily that showed the long-term evidence of using selumetinib. And a lot of their patients had been using selumetinib for 5, 6, 8 years. And they saw that there wasn't any significant concern for additional side effects with long-term use of selumetinib. But they also saw that some patients that had been tolerating it pretty well for a couple of years, 3, 4 years, started developing symptoms or side effects then, which tells us that even if a patient is doing really well on therapy for 3 or 4 years, that doesn't mean that we can't relax in terms of our monitoring, that we need to keep a close eye on them. So no new safety signals, but you definitely need to continue monitoring these patients. And the other thing that we learned is that they had great responses, but some of them developed progressive disease while on treatment. So responses are not seen right away. It can take up to 12 or more cycles. The median time to initial response was 8 cycles, ranging from 4 cycles to 40 cycles of treatment before a response was seen. And each cycle is 28 days long. The median time to best response was 18 cycles. So people have to be patient. And the median duration to partial response was 34 cycles. So that's a long time of waiting. And you can see that some of these patients had progressive disease. Again, in this study with the 5-year follow-up, additional 5-year follow-up published last year, they saw that GI and skin toxicity as well as increased CPK were the most common problems. And unfortunately, 29%, so almost 40% of those patients needed to have had problems with selumetinib, and 54% had to discontinue therapy. So half of those patients had to come off of treatment due to either principal investigator discretion, side effects in some cases, and others that weren't specified. Okay. Thank you. What else can we do with MEK inhibitors beyond plexiform neurofibroma treatments?
Well, thank you for asking, Carlos. I'll be happy to talk about that. So let's continue with this case-based format then. We'll talk about this 21-year-old. So this 21-year-old with NF1 was seen urgently in clinic because she had a softball-sized painful mass on her right shoulder. She said that the pain and the swelling started about 2 weeks ago, and on exam, she had a really large softball size, 9 centimeter by 8 centimeter, really firm mass on her right shoulder. It was very exquisitely tender to light palpation, and she even had limited right shoulder abduction due to this pain. So she urgently got an MRI, and you can see a large heterogeneous tumor within her right brachial plexus here, with subsequent PET imaging showing that this had very high avidity, making us very concerned about a malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor for her. Let's also talk about one more case, too, where we're thinking about possible MEK inhibitor therapies. This was a 3-year-old who had longstanding intermittent exotropia and new optic nerve edema. So she was referred by her ophthalmologist, who had been previously following her for her exotropia, but saw that she had this new 3+ optic nerve edema on her right eye. So she sent her over to us, didn't have any family history, nor did the patient have a diagnosis of NF1, but on exam, she clearly had multiple Caffarelli macules, bilateral axillary inguinal freckling, met clinical diagnostic criteria for NF1, and this is her MRI here that shows a right pre-chiasmatic, so optic nerve pathway glioma here. So what we can talk about from these two cases, this 21-year-old with NF1 and new diagnosis of MPNST, and then in this 3-year-old with a new diagnosis of NF1 and an optic pathway glioma, we can talk about what are the standards of care for MPNSTs and NF1-associated low-grade gliomas. Also, is there a role for MEK inhibitors in treating MPNSTs or these NF1-associated low-grade gliomas? Let's talk about that. So about a little intro about malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors. The overall incidence of this in our individuals with NF1 is quite high. They have about a 10% lifetime risk of developing an MPNST. But not all MPNSTs occur in those who have NF1. About half of all MPNSTs are happening in patients who have NF1. MPNSTs, in general, they're a very locally aggressive soft tissue sarcoma that has this nerve sheath differentiation, and they really, unfortunately, like to metastasize. In NF1, typically we see malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors from malignant transformation of a pre-existing plexiform neurofibroma. Traditionally, it's been a very hard to treat cancer, with 20 to 50% of patients surviving 5 years from diagnosis. Looking at the overall pathology of high-grade MPNSTs, we definitely see the biallelic NF1 loss, and we also frequently see these other genetic tumor drivers as well. Understanding which ones are targetable is still a point of active research, and we could talk about some of the clinical research studies that have been trying to address improvement in the outcomes for those with MPNSTs and NF1. So I highlighted a little bit about, or I hinted that chemotherapy plays a limited role. And so the mainstay when we talk about treatment for MPNSTs is definitely surgery. We try to get as much out as possible, but it's in some of these locations, just like how Carlos referred to, in those areas that have that are hard to have a full resection for, it may be really difficult to get a full excision or even wide margins. And so it's really important before surgery that we try to get a reliable diagnosis if we're going to be doing a really drastic surgery and avoid any unnecessary loss of function. Because if it really isn't an MPNST, maybe we can be a little bit less aggressive and do more of a nerve sparing surgery. Again, despite the curative intent, our overall survival is still very poor. Although, thankfully, for our kids, they have a little bit better survival than our adults. In terms of chemotherapy, again, very limited role. In some of the adults, usually ifosfamide and doxorubicin are used as the backbone. In pediatrics, it can vary a little bit more. Some people use vincristine, cyclophosphamide, ifosfamide, doxorubicin, and actinomycin. And then radiation therapy. So it's really hard. There is a lack of standardization of this as well, especially in the pediatric setting. Some people would say that they would use irradiation just for increased local control. I would say definitely that if there is still residual tumor after having had surgery, that radiation therapy can be considered. Or sometimes we use prior to surgery to try to improve more of a resection ability. So there have been several phase two trials that have been led by the group, the SARC group, sarcoma group. And what I'll just highlight here in the red is that unfortunately, most of them have no partial or complete response despite multiple different agents with different mechanisms of actions being targeted. The most promising possibly would be that there were 9 patients in the SARC-006 study that I'll talk about next here. So in SARC-006, it was a phase 2 trial that was looking at chemotherapy for people who had NF1-associated MPNSTs, as well as those who had sporadic MPNSTs. And overall, they were looking at only 2D tumor measurements. This was a little bit of an older study before we could get into volumetrics. And the overall response rate in the NF1 population was 17%. And in the sporadic setting, again, the lower number is 44%. And you can see just from the number of patients that were part of this study that we cannot actually compare with any statistical significance. But overall, still looking pretty dismal in terms of being able to help with our patients with MPNSTs, especially in the NF1 setting. So secondarily, there's been another sarcoma trial, SARC-031, which has looked at the role of selumetinib along with sirolimus, an mTOR inhibitor in MPNSTs. The results of this are still forthcoming, but it's very eagerly awaited. They were looking to see if there was any clinical benefit rate at 4 months, also looking at toxicities, as well as the impact on intensity and pain, and then, of course, looking at progression-free survival and overall survival. There are also ongoing studies. I'll just highlight a couple. So there is the neoadjuvant use of nivolumab and ipilimumab for newly diagnosed MPNSTs. And this is a phase 1 trial for kids 12 years and older, and looking again first at safety feasibility and then possibly also looking at objective response rate as well. And then here in Seattle at the Fred Hutch Center, we have pembrolizumab and radiation therapy for the treatment of intermediate or high-grade soft tissue sarcomas. And this is a phase 2 study that is looking to evaluate complete tumor necrosis in patients who receive pembro and radiation. This is available for our older patients, 18 years and older. So then I will transition to a little bit of a lighter topic, CNS tumors in NF1, and talk about the potential role of MEK inhibitors for those. So the most common NF1-associated CNS tumors are gliomas, and very common, again, about 20 to 30% of our kids with NF1 will be developing a CNS glioma. Most commonly, they occur in the optic pathway or in the brainstem, but they are very benign, slow-growing, and if If they are able to be resective, that's usually curative, but often because of the location, that's not possible. Traditionally, NF1 patients actually have a better outcomes overall, in that many of them, or the majority of them, do not actually need therapy and are asymptomatic from these tumors. And also, we can see instances of spontaneous regression of these type of tumors sometimes in NF1. This is more for your reference in looking at the molecular landscape of gliomas and NF1. There are genetic alterations that we typically see in high-grade gliomas, and then we can also see some classic findings in low-grade gliomas as well. The average age at diagnosis of optic pathway gliomas is usually around 2 to 4 years. And I alluded to this, but less than half of them are actually going to require therapy. One important point is, just because something is growing on an MRI does not necessarily mean that visual outcomes are also being affected too. So it's definitely a situation where you need to look at the clinical picture of our patients. And also understanding that the clinical picture of our patients with NF1 also have a different picture than those who have sporadic optic pathway gliomas. So there are many things that you can think about when you're trying to decide whether you should start treatment in someone who has an NF1-associated optic pathway glioma, including tumor growth or visual acuity, or can you even get a reliable visual acuity, or actual even the involvement. Where is it? Where is the tumor? And there are multiple different ways of being able to follow or to treat these tumors, and I'll have this here for your reference. But in terms of standard of care, for the treatment of NF1-associated low-grade gliomas, carboplatin vincristine has been the gold standard for quite some time. And this was based on the results of the CCG89952 study, which was a phase 2 study looking at kids with NF1 and newly diagnosed low-grade gliomas. Overall survival, excellent. Progression-free survival, about 70%. That's great. However, if you're looking at the adverse events, there were quite a number of side effects secondary to this treatment. Commonly used treatment has been vinblastine, and this is also based off of a phase 2 study looking at vinblastine monotherapy in recurrent and refractory, so not the newly diagnosed, but more in the refractory or recurrent setting of pediatric low-grade gliomas. And the overall survival, again, was great. Event-free survival, not bad, 5 years at 42%, but then again, also having some more significant adverse events, including neutropenia and then anemia sufficient to require transfusion. So when we're looking at then treatment with our NF1-associated low-grade gliomas, there has been a great study from the PBTC group, which was a phase 2 study looking at our pediatric patients, and they were able to find that 40% of the patients had a complete or partial response with a 2-year progression-free survival of 96%. And this is a waterfall graph from that paper, where you can see in this setting that essentially everyone had either stable to response of their low-grade glioma. And very importantly, looking at the safety, there was low instances of grade 3 or higher adverse events. So this led to the creation of the COG-ACNS-1831 study, which is a head-to-head looking at selumetinib versus carboplatin vincristine in kids who had a previously untreated NF1 low-grade glioma. This is currently ongoing. It's a phase 3 randomized control study. Has a 2-to-1 ratio of having selumetinib be the designated drug versus carboplatin vincristine. So it is a non-inferiority study, and they're looking at visual outcomes, but also looking at very important secondary objectives, such as improvement in motor function, quality of life, visual outcomes, as well as other cognitive, social, emotional, and behavior functioning. So in sum, in this last workshop here, we talked about three different cases where we have a two-year-old girl diagnosed with NF1 at birth, brought to clinic because she had the bump in her right hand that Carlos talked about. I mentioned a 21-year-old with NF1 who had the softball-sized painful mass on her right shoulder. And we talked about this 3-year-old who had exotropia and new optic nerve edema. So thinking about these three separate cases, is there a role for MEK inhibitors in the treatment of these NF tumors? Hopefully, I've been able to convince you, or we have been able to convince you, that in plexiform neurofibromas, absolutely. In MPNSTs, MEK inhibitors cannot prevent MPNSTs from forming, nor are they sufficient in being able to treat MPNSTs by themselves. And in the case of NF1 associated low-grade gliomas, there's definitely great evidence suggesting that that it is effective. And with the results of the ACNS 1831 study, we'll see the results, but potentially could maybe even become the new standard of care.
I hope this session was helpful. Thanks again for being here and for joining us online.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/XSH860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Alexion Pharmaceuticals.